Next case up is Robbins versus Robertson, Mrs. Sternlieb. Miss Sternlieb, I'm sorry. MS, period.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Sarah Sternlieb, the plaintiff appellant, Marquise Robbins. Mr. Robbins filed a handwritten pro se complaint alleging that Valdosta State Prison served him vegan meals that were underportioned, inedible, and often included non-vegan foods. They were contaminated with items prohibited by his religious beliefs. He alleged he lost weight, he had throbbing headaches, and suffered other effects of malnutrition, which necessitated treatment by the medical unit. This went on for 3 months straight, and although the quality of the meals improved for a brief period of time, the food soon reverted back to the earlier insufficient conditions.
He also got vitamins for a period, didn't he?
After he went to the medical unit and they gave him a blood test, they determined that he needed treatment, and he was given not only a multivitamin, but he was also prescribed a supplemental medical meal, which was in addition to the food that he was receiving normally.
Right.
The district court overlooked the underlying facts and instead focused solely on the legalese peppered throughout Mr. Robbins' handwritten
My understanding complaint. Is that, and maybe I'm wrong about this, but the district court wasn't so much denying that he had a right under the First Amendment to this kind of meal, but simply that under a Twombly sort of approach that he just had conclusory labels and things to suggest, you know, stringy food, unwholesome, unbalanced, the kind of thing any prisoner could come back and probably say about their food, and it wasn't enough. Tell me what you think in his complaint was specific enough that it would get us past those Twombly concerns.
Well, I think that, Your Honor, there were a couple of facts, and I agree that you're right, that it was that the district court was not alleging that he was not entitled to a religious dietary accommodation. But he alleged a number of facts throughout his complaint. He alleged that from January 8th until April 8th, and then again after June 2015, the meals that VSP provided were, and I quote, meager, improperly prepared, and at times inedible. He alleged that the food was diluted and stretched, which reduced the nutritional content, and that the meals did not provide the requisite amount of calories or protein. He also alleged that
the bottom line fact that they were contaminated.
Excuse me, Your Honor?
Isn't the fact that they were contaminated the strongest point you have?
I think that that's another point that makes...
Well, that's what meant he couldn't eat them.
Well, I think there are two separate facts. There's the facts that go to that the food that he was provided that was vegan was inadequate. And there are the facts about contamination, which meant that the food that he was provided was in those...
Well, that's what puts him to the choice.
Excuse me?
Puts him to the choice. He isn't put to a First Amendment choice over the fact that maybe the portions aren't quite large enough or he isn't getting enough to feel well, right?
I believe that he is put to a First Amendment and RLUIPA choice based on the fact that he isn't given enough food to sustain his nutrition. I think the fact that he's also forced to either violate his religion by eating contaminated food or to not eat it and therefore go hungry is another reason why it's a substantial burden. But how
specific is your, what you're really arguing is an allegation that my food did not contain adequate nutritional value to sustain a person is a specific enough allegation for him to go forward?
I think it was not just that it was inadequate. It was the facts that I just stated before. We also have to consider that on Saturdays, the meals that he received was simply 5 peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, and they usually contained jelly, which he could not eat because it contained pork ingredients.
I gather if they just given him peanut butter, that would have been fine. It was the jelly that was the problem. It had gelatin. Yeah.
So, I agree, Your Honor.
And that the allegation is that that's every Saturday from January straight through. That doesn't change during the time that he's on the medical diet.
He did not specify whether that changed during the time that he was on the medical diet, but on the medical
If I'm construing the complaint most favorably to him as I'm required to, do I assume that the Saturday problem was throughout?
I agree, and I would also point out that...
That means on one day of the week, he's making the tree, isn't getting any food because of his free exercise.
You're right, and that's a problem, but I would also point out...
A problem? Why isn't that enough on its own?
I would believe that it is enough on its own, but the fact is that we look at the complaint as a whole, and we have significantly more than that. And just to clarify about the medical meals that he was provided, for more than 2 out of the 3 months that it was prescribed, it included meat in it and milk, such that the only thing he could eat out of that diet meant to supplement his current nutrition was an apple or an orange.
Does his complaint indicate that pursuant to his Muslim belief he had to have a vegan meal, that is, he couldn't eat eggs or milk or drink milk?
So what he alleged was his beliefs was that he is prohibited from consuming meat or any animal products or byproducts, which would include eggs and cheese, without sufficient knowledge of how the food product was prepared, and that's per his religious beliefs, that any contact with food that was not vegan, i.e. not coming from an animal, would be an immediate contamination. And there are multiple courts of appeals that have recognized this concern with contamination in inmates that are trying to keep a halal or vegan diet. The vegan diets are given to prisoners as a cost-effective way so that the prisons don't have to buy kosher and halal meat. It's just an easier way to ensure that they're not being given food that would violate their religion.
Well, is your strongest argument that a lot of these things do seem vague, and they seem like the nutritional value is something specific to him, but the general unwholesome and contaminated is probably going to be something any inmate can talk about. Is not your strongest argument that he has some corroboration through the fact he goes to the medical unit and he is determined to be malnourished?
Yes, I agree, and I think that even if those allegations are more vague, we know exactly what happened here, that it caused him to lose 15 pounds, that he experienced throbbing headaches, weakness, and other health effects, and that he was not only seen...
What caused it? Was it him not eating, or was him eating food that wasn't sufficiently nutritional?
The way I read it is that he wasn't eating enough food, and I think that's either enough food that he...
Or he was eating contaminated food.
He does not specifically allege whether he was eating contaminated food or not.
How can we even get a hold of his case if we don't know what he was doing?
Well, I think, first off, if you're concerned about that, it can be remanded for him to file a more specific amended complaint, which this court has held is the proper thing to do.
He's had 2 chances.
Excuse me?
He's had 2 chances. He's got his original complaint, and he's had 1 amendment.
Even when a prisoner has amended a case as of right, this court has held that that a more carefully drafted complaint could state a claim, and the district court should give them the opportunity to remand. Because it's really the semantics. But whether he ate contaminated food or didn't eat it is itself would be problematic. A substantial burden talks about the choice, and it's the contamination issue is a fear of contamination. If he ate it, then that would violate his religion. If he didn't eat it, then he would go hungry, and he would be denied a benefit, which is exactly what the First Amendment in RLUIPA prohibits.
So we're unclear from the complaint whether he was losing weight because he said, I'm not going to eat this, picky eater, I'm not going to eat this, or if he's losing weight because he was trying to eat it sometimes and it just didn't have enough calories or protein for him. We're not clear which he's alleging.
Yes, but my argument is that that's a substantial burden either way, that it would be because he's violating his religion or that he's not. It would also be a substantial burden if from time to time he, on days when he was hungrier, he ate food that he thought was contaminated and violated his religion, or on days when he was feeling more fulsome that he didn't eat the food and that he was denied a benefit.
That first, if you covered, would not violate the Eighth Amendment.
Which would, excuse me?
If he was hungry and ate the food, regardless of it violating his religious beliefs, that would not violate the Eighth Amendment if he got the nutritional sustenance from eating the food.
Your Honor, I think that's a question that is more open. I personally would argue that that would be an Eighth Amendment violation, but we don't have that issue here.
How could it be cruel and unusual punishment physically inflicted, which is all that the Eighth Amendment has ever been interpreted to cover, physical infliction of pain and suffering? How would it be that if he ate the food and it was an adequate diet, nutritionally? Eighth Amendment.
Well, here, even let's say he did eat the food here. He lost weight.
That is what you said.
Yeah. I think that that's a separate question that's not at issue because we know that he experienced direct health effects from this,
I don't understand then why you were discussing that possibility.
Of whether he...
You said, let's assume that he ate, that he, in spite of his religious objections, ate the food.
I think that even if he ate the food, it shows that the food he was given was not enough.
Okay, so...
And so that would be an inadequate diet, which would be a violation both of the Eighth Amendment and the First Amendment.
Okay, if he ate the food, but it wasn't adequate, and it was sufficiently inadequate that it violated the Eighth Amendment, it would still violate the Eighth Amendment.
Yes. I mean,
we understand that.
Yes.
Okay, proceed.
My remaining time, if I could turn to the question of mootness about the RLUIPA claim. I believe that the controlling law in the circuit holds that absent defendant's counsel advisement that the appellant wouldn't be returned to the subject prison, the same alleged conduct could occur and the issue is not be moot. The defendants here have not assured that, and in fact, Mr. Robbins has already been transferred back to VSP once. Just as in this court's cases in Lemkuhl and in Dacre, where the plaintiffs not only were subject to transfer back, but they had in fact been transferred, that this court should at least remand and allow the district court to examine the issue.
Let me ask you this, as to whether the mootness issue really matters. If you prevail on your Eighth Amendment claim, he's entitled to damages, right?
Correct.
And that will be in a decision which is binding on the DOC in the future, at least as it involves this inmate, will it not?
I would believe so, but...
So he will get the relief that he would get on the RLUIPA claim, will he not?
Well, the first step for the First Amendment and RLUIPA are the same. And if you're saying talking about whether he succeeds on the First Amendment, it's the second step that changes for RLUIPA and the First Amendment that the district court did not reach. There's a different burden for the defendants to prove, which is a higher burden under RLUIPA, which is why I think it would make a difference if that claim was also kept live.
Yeah, but if he gets the relief on the Eighth Amendment claim...
You mean First Amendment?
I'm sorry. If he gets the relief on the constitutional claim, let's keep it at that level of generality, that will prohibit the Department of Corrections from repeating the harm to him in the future, will it not? They will be bound not to do so by the judgment, will they not?
I can see my time is up, but if I could just answer Chief Judge Carnes' question. I agree that you are correct there. However, first we have to win on that claim, not just be remanded back to the district court.
I understand, but you said RLUIPA is a higher burden.
It is.
So if you're going to win on the RLUIPA, you're going to win on the constitutional claim.
That is accurate.
All right, so put RLUIPA aside. If you win on the constitutional claim, you have a judgment which binds these defendants and their successors in office not to do this again. Because if they do, they'll be paying more damages. So why do you need a statutory claim that has a higher burden that will result in the same effect, i.e. injunction to prevent them from doing it in the future? You get an implicit injunction with a judgment against them for money damages because they're not going to continue paying him money damages over the time horizon. So I don't understand why that's not practical mootness. It doesn't matter. The RLUIPA claim doesn't matter. And if you lose the constitutional claims, you're going to lose the RLUIPA claim.
I think it's actually backwards. The defendants have a higher burden to prove the RLUIPA claim, not the First Amendment claim.
Defendants don't have to prove claims.
The defendants have a higher burden to show that there was under RLUIPA, they would have to show that there's a compelling government interest that's the least restrictive means. And under the First Amendment, they would have to show just that it's a legitimate penological interest.
Okay. I misunderstood your statement. I apologize.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Ms. Gore.
Good morning. May it please the court. Deborah Gore for the defendants and appellees, Marty Allen and William Robertson. I'd like to start briefly with the mootness issue and address what counsel has said with regard to, I think, what was characterized as binding authority on this court. I think what I'd first like to point out is the general rule in this circuit, which has been the general rule for decades now, and that is that a transfer of an inmate from one institution or out of custody moots a claim when that claim involves allegations of conditions of confinement at the original institution. That's what we have here.
Unless there is an institution-wide policy.
That's correct, Your Honor. Unless there is an institution-wide policy, because in that case, no matter what institution the inmate is being held at, the policy will affect him. So the court can grant adequate relief to that inmate. We don't have that here. We have a situation where Mr. Robbins was transferred in 2016 out of VSP, and we have a situation where his allegations are very specific to Valdosta State Prison. He's no longer there, so the result is the court really can't grant him any effective injunctive relief by directing individuals at Valdosta State Prison to take certain acts. That's what this court has long held, and that's what the court should find here. The claim is moot. Now, I want to briefly address Hardwick, because I know that's what the appellants rely on, but Hardwick is not and should not be controlling here. Hardwick, which is a 1975 Fifth Circuit case, is distinguishable. But before I mention that, I want to mention that it is a 1975 case, and although adopted as precedent in this court, there are countless 11th Circuit cases since that time that have continued to apply the general rule of mootness. Transfer results in mootness in the situations that I just mentioned. So there's that. But there's also subsequent 11th Circuit rulings that point out why Hardwick is distinguishable. In McKinnon v. Talladega County, it was a situation of a transfer and an allegation of mootness in an attempt to apply Hardwick by the appellant to say, well, it's not moot because of Hardwick. And this court pointed out that the Hardwick decision is unique. In that case, the plaintiff had brought three cases in three different three different district courts, and the court was looking for a way to consolidate them into one. And perhaps more importantly, that was a challenge to the legal mail system system-wide. So it's not controlling here. This court has not applied it the way that the appellant asked that it be applied. And quite frankly, even the Fifth Circuit since that time has not done that. Instead, it has applied the same rule that the 11th Circuit has applied. So I think that the law is pretty clear. In this case, mootness applies. And as far as the Dacre ruling that was referenced, again, this court even specifically mentioned, under the particular circumstances of Dacre, we will remand for factual findings on mootness. Those circumstances don't apply here. The record in that case had evidence of transfers back to the institution at issue.
Who's the burden on the transfer back issue?
The burden is on the appellant. The burden is on the appellant because this court has said that repeatedly, and not only this court, but the Supreme Court has said that repeatedly. In defining, what we're talking about here is whether or not the exception to the mootness doctrine applies, and that the capable of repetition. And what Weinstein v. Bradford, a United States Supreme Court, said is that that applies not only in narrow circumstances, but only when there's a reasonable expectation the same complaining party will be subject to the same action, and followed up by the Lyons, L.A. versus Lyons, where the United States Supreme Court said, the doctrine applies only where the named plaintiff can make a reasonable showing that he will again be subject.
Hardwick said, unless the defendants guarantee that the prisoner will not be returned to the prison where his rights were violated.
I agree that it says that, Your Honor. That is correct. But again, because that has not been applied in that manner.
It doesn't matter how it's been applied. It's prior panel precedent.
And in addition to that, and again, I do acknowledge it's 1975 Fifth Circuit, so it does constitute precedent. It hasn't been applied that way, but in addition, as I mentioned, that involved a situation of a challenge to a legal mail system that was system-wide.
Yeah, but it's talking about transfer to another prison. Does transfer to another prison moot it? And they said only if the defendants guarantee he won't be transferred back.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. I would like to point, though, to more recent cases of this court. For an example, Spears v. Thigpen, 1998, 11th Circuit Court. There was a transfer within the same prison system. I believe that was the Alabama Department of Corrections system. That transfer was within the system, and this court did not require or even mention any requirement that the defendant make assurances of a non-transfer. It applied the general rule of this circuit and found that the transfer mooted the injunctive relief claim, even though it was within the same system. And this court, even more recently as last month in April, in rulings involving mootness, potential mootness, transfers within the same prison system, has not looked to the defendant to make assurances. And I think finally in that point, I'd note also, the defendant, this is not a case against the Department of Corrections. This is a case where the plaintiff has sued two individuals who happen to no longer work at the Department of Corrections with respect to one and the other who's on leave, but not at Valdosta. It's not targeted at the Georgia Department of Corrections, nor could they have any capability of making any assurances about where someone is transferred. They just simply don't have that authority. So I think that is another way in which this case is just not ripe for
applicability. Are you arguing that a judgment here in favor of Mr. Robbins wouldn't have any binding effect on the institution? The next man, when Mr. Robertson is gone and the next person who's in there, assume Robertson loses here and has to pay some money and has a risk of contempt from a future event, as the chief judge was talking about. Are you saying to me that the institution is scot-free?
No, I'm not saying that, Your Honor. Certainly a new warden would be substituted in if you're talking about injunctive relief in an official capacity. What I'm saying is that in this case, to the extent appellants asking for assurances, they haven't sued the Department of the Corrections, and there's nothing in the record, and I don't believe it exists, any authority for a warden to be making assurances as to where an inmate can and cannot be transferred. The defendants in this case simply can't do that. And more importantly, this court has not required them to do that. With the exception of the Hardwick case, they haven't required them to do that in almost identical circumstances. If I might, I'd like to go on and speak a little bit to the substantial burden, First Amendment, and RLUIPA underlying claim should it not be found moot.
I found interesting about your brief, ma'am, is on the First Amendment issue, we have 3 months in which, and plus possibly a month in June, in which there's an allegation that the food was contaminated to such an extent that he's put to this choice under his religion. So you have contamination that I don't believe you address at all in your brief. And I'm being generous when I say you walk away from Saturdays. So why isn't there a sufficiently pled First Amendment claim here when someone comes in and says for three and a half or perhaps four months, with all of my meals, every day I'm getting contaminated food and I'm getting nothing on Saturdays?
I think, Your Honor, because he doesn't act, he does, when you look at all of the allegations.
Why didn't you address the contamination?
I believe in our brief we argued that he hasn't alleged that he has not been unable to eat any meal due to contamination, and he hasn't specifically alleged that his burden is
well,
a result.
Well, that goes to whether or not he did or didn't eat them. His argument is that when I'm being put to the choice, when they slide the contaminated tray through the slot, take one look at it every day for 4 months, and I say, if I eat this, I'm not going to the promised land, and I'm going to starve to death. I don't really have any choice, and I'm on that Hobson's choice.
Certainly.
Are you saying that he doesn't have a First Amendment right at all unless he says he actually ate it?
No, I'm not saying that, Your Honor, but I would respectfully disagree that he has pled what you have just so artfully stated in your question.
Well, he's not required to be as artful as I am.
That's true. He's not. And I'm not holding him to that or asking the court to hold him to that standard. But as far as the contamination, I think it's very important to look at the entire complaint and look at what he has said and not said. Now, he does say that the trays are placed next to non-vegan trays and that he he says that
the fact that they weren't wrapped this is a key problem. For the first 4 months, they're totally unwrapped. They come down from the trail with the other stuff. Every tenet of his religion is violated right away.
He does say
that. And then he has a problem on Saturdays when they come and they say, well, here, Saturday's a long day. And he gets, what, 2 peanut butter sandwiches for breakfast and 3 for lunch is the idea. That's what he says, and you have to take that as true. And he can't eat any of them.
Again, Your Honor.
You're just contaminated again, right?
I respectfully disagree that he has said that I cannot eat anything on Saturdays. What he has said...
What did he say about Saturday?
He said the sandwiches are consistently blended with jelly. He does state that his religion...
And the jelly makes it contaminated.
Well, he says that he states that his religion, his religious beliefs require him to refrain from jelly without knowledge as to whether it includes pork or ingredients... other meat ingredients where he doesn't know how the animal has been slain. He indicates that jelly usually contains gelatin, and gelatin is usually extracted from pork ingredients. What he's alleging, Your Honor, is that I'm on the vegan meal plan. I saw that they put jelly.
Oh, wait, start with the fact that the jelly is extracted from the wrong source. Is that just wildly preposterous?
It's not wildly...
You can't get rid of that allegation on the wildly preposterous ground.
No, but, Your Honor, I would say that he has made it clear in other parts of his complaint when there is a food item he cannot eat.
What I wonder in the first place is whether I ought to be listening to you on this at all, because you made no argument in your brief whatsoever about Saturdays. You said, oh, my goodness, with the exception of Saturdays, everything was fine. That's what your brief said.
Well, I believe, Your Honor, we did address the Saturdays and his allegation of the Saturday meals, and that overall, when you look at his...
You didn't challenge the question of whether or not the jelly was contaminated.
I don't know that we discussed in detail whether the jelly was contaminated.
Well, then we have to accept as granted that he's saying the truth of the pleading.
But he doesn't say this jelly was contaminated. He essentially says, I don't know, and I haven't been told. He doesn't...
Well, that's the same nature of the problem when they give him the tray, the food that they put to him. He couldn't be certain that what they slid under the door was contaminated, but he knew it hadn't been protected.
Yes, Your Honor, he does say those things, but he also states that the choice I was put to was not between... violating my religious beliefs because I had to consume contaminated food and some other thing. He specifically alleges over and over, the choice I was put to was starvation and malnutrition or eat a non-vegan meal. That's how he has pled his complaint. And although he does discuss contamination...
You're saying he's not alleging that he had to make a choice based on religion?
He does say he had to make a choice based on religion.
And isn't that enough?
It isn't enough because in this case, the choice he talks about is a choice between malnutrition and starvation and not eating a vegan meal. But when we look at everything, and we have to look at everything in his complaint, we can't just look at certain select facts. He does allege a lot, but what he alleges,
alleges that his complaints worked, and for 3 months after April, they changed.
Yes, but he also alleges that he alleges something that's simply not plausible, which is I was either completely unable to eat any of these meals, or I ate them, but they were so meager, diluted, and insufficient that I am placed to a substantial...
He doesn't exactly say those words you just said, right? You're characterizing...
I'm characterizing.
Yes, thank you.
Yes,
and that's not really fair, is it?
Well, I think for purpose of the argument, I'm just trying to boil it down.
I know that, but that's not the argument. What we're talking about is whether or not he pled a complaint that would stand up under Twombly.
And our position is that it wouldn't stand up under Twombly because it has to be a plausible claim. And what's not plausible is that he either didn't eat or ate such meager food for a three-month period of time, and then when
his... he was put to a choice. His claim is that he was put to a choice to eat because he was served up with food that he had reason to believe was contaminated.
Yes, I see I've run out of time. May I answer your question, Your Honor?
Sure. Yes, and the one before it as well.
Okay, if I can recall what that was. Our position is that he has argued something that's implausible. And there is a plausibility requirement for pleading, even at the motion to dismiss stage. What he's pled is that the meals were so meager that I suffered physical injury. And he does plead physical injury. Of course he does. But we also know that he spent 3 months on this diet, is seen by what he terms to be a qualified physician, or a proper physician, I think is the term he used. And that proper physician evaluated him and said, right at this point in your evaluation, I'm prescribing you a multivitamin. Our position is that it's simply not plausible to be taking in the type of meals that Mr. Robbins described, which are general descriptions. So we have to look to these more specific facts. What does it mean diluted? What does it mean not nutritionally adequate? Well, let's look.
The way you're constructing your argument, you're jumping from one to the other. It's simply implausible that
he was on a diet so inadequate in nutrition, and yet after 3 months on this diet, a proper physician, as he terms it, evaluates him and prescribes a mere multivitamin. And it's implausible it's implausible that he was facing substantial
pressure. An enhanced diet, a medical diet.
After 2 weeks later, he was placed on that. But we do know
it takes 2 weeks for him to, get the message to come down to the kitchen.
You were
saying basically all he got was he can't be very sick because they just gave him a multivitamin.
We are saying that, Your Honor. Yes,
And were the blood tests back at the time they gave the multivitamin?
The blood test wasn't back, and when the blood test was back, he was given the supplemental meal,
which we
know is a sandwich and fruit. And our position is that
sandwich he couldn't eat.
He could not eat the sandwich, but again, at that time, it was also a time when the meals hadn't improved.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Ms. Sternlieb, 3 minutes.
Your Honors, the Supreme Court in Erickson, while it was considering Iqbal, specifically said that specific facts are not necessary. All that the plaintiff has to do is give the defendant fair notice of what the claim is and the grounds for which it rests. It is clear that the defendants know exactly what Mr. Robbins alleged and what his problems are. It's clearly plausible. The defendants are effectively arguing that because he hasn't died already or he's not knocking at the courthouse doors, that his claims are not plausible. But we're looking at what he alleged in the complaint, and that on itself, with the multiple facts that he alleged were sufficient. He alleged that the vegan meals were underportioned, they provide insufficient calories and protein. On Saturdays, he was served entirely non-vegan foods. He was given a medical meal diet after it was determined that his nutrition was suffering and that the medical meal diet itself was not vegan, and that the food was so inadequate that he lost over 15 pounds in a short period of time and experienced other effects. After he was seen at the medical unit, they were entirely unsurprised at his condition and called it the Marty Allen diet. While he resides at the one other prison offering his necessary conditions of confinement, he may and already has before been transferred back to VSP. This is enough to overcome a motion to dismiss. If I may turn to defendants' arguments on the mootness issue. Transfer to the cases that defendants have cited, including the Spears case that they just referred to, were cases where the transfer was where the plaintiff changed status. So in Spears, he was in administrative segregation, and it doesn't say that he was transferred in the same system. And in all the other cases that they cited, these were transfers where the prisoner was released, where they were just transferred from county prison to state or federal prison, where there's no actual likelihood that he may go back to the one place that Mr. Robbins can go back to. In Dacre, they transferred because, exactly as we have here, that the plaintiff was already transferred back to the subject prison.
I thought there were three prisons in the state that gave VGen diets.
That is what the defendants argue. However, based but on what...
Is that right or not?
If we look at the document that they actually cited, the document doesn't even say that VSP or Hayes State, where Mr. Robbins currently is, offers a vegan diet, which presumably they do. So I would have to question that and ask for more facts.
Yeah, but if it's under-inclusive, that doesn't help you, the list.
If it's...
You're saying that we should disregard the list because it doesn't include the institution he is now at, which should be included, is one that offers the vegan diet.
Well,
that doesn't help you. If it's over-inclusive, if there's one in there that doesn't offer it, then that's a grounds for questioning the accuracy of the others that are included in the list.
You're right that it may be under-inclusive, but the other issue is that Mr. Robbins has to be is close security in a one-man protective cell unit, and from what he has stated, that the only two prisons that offer that, along with a vegan diet, is VSP and HSP.
Yeah, one of which is okay, the other which is not, right?
He also alleges that he's experiencing similar issues in HSP, which is why this case is actually much more like Hardwick, and why I think these cases are alive and need to be remanded. Thank you, Your Honors.
I understand. Thank you, Counsel. We'll take that case under submission and stand in recess.
All right.